Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. You're in for a very special treat tonight, as my guest is the world-famous revisionist from France, Professor Robert Faurisson. For many of you, he needs no introduction. But for those listeners who may not be as familiar with the Holocaust revisionist personalities, I will tell you that Professor Faurisson taught French literature at the University of Lyon until 1990, with a specialty in the study of documents. His involvement with Holocaust revisionism began back in 1974 with a letter to Yad Vashem, the Israel Center for Shoah Remembrance, expressing skepticism about this genocide of Jews based on the available records and testimony. Since then, he has written many outstanding papers on subjects such as the authenticity of the Diary of Anne Frank, responses to Pierre Vidal-Naquet and Jean-Claude Pressac, who are two French exterminationists, as special Holocaust terminology, and a paper called The Victories of Revisionism. He also played a major role in the Canadian trials of the 1980s of Ernst Zundel. He has also suffered physical attacks by Jewish thugs, one of which left him unconscious and bloodied, and he had to be hospitalized. In short, Faurisson has been very much the activist as well as a scholarly writer, and for that he's won high admiration. Professor Faurisson, welcome to the Heretics Hour.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'm very pleased that you are here. Is there anything about my introduction of you that you would like to question or add to?
The principle is that in Paris we have a center of Jewish documentation, and I worked years and years in that place, in the library and in the archives. They didn't know at that time that I was a revisionist. I visited plenty of concentration camps. I visited in Washington, D.C., the Holocaust Memorial Museum. I had even a meeting with Mr. Berenbaum. I could say some things about that.
I wish you would.
He is
the director.
At that time, he was, I think it was in perhaps 1994, something like that. I insisted on visiting him. First, I made a visit with two friends, witnesses. And then I did exactly like an American would do. I was very direct. And in the lobby, I said, I wish to talk to Mr. Berenbaum. And a lady said, okay. And I had immediately Berenbaum on the phone. And I said, Mr. Berenbaum, my name is Robert Faurisson. I wish to visit you. And I was surprised when he said, it's 3:45, it means that you'll be in my office at 4:15. So I went to his office with my two friends, and the reception by Berenbaum was icy cold.
He was quite aware of who you were and your reputation?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
When we got into the room, I saw on a, do you say, a sofa, two gentlemen, rather old gentlemen, and Berenbaum told me that they were, I think I remember something like the director and another director of the Holocaust Memorial Museum. I think that Berenbaum, knowing my way of making investigations, knew that one day I would come to his place. And they had decided, I suppose, that if ever Faurisson would come, there would be those two directors who would be there. And our conversation would be registered. So Berenbaum, very arrogant, said, "So, why do you want to see me?" I said, "Oh, it's very simple. On the book, I don't know how you call this kind of book. You see, any visitor can sign something on the book when he has finished his visit. On your, we call that in France, un livre d'or, a golden book. On the book, I wrote, I have visited this place. I have not found an answer to my question, which is, as you know, show me or draw me a Nazi gas chamber." It's quite strange that in such a museum, you cannot have a physical representation of the weapon of the crime. So, if I wanted to visit you, it's precisely to ask you, how is it that I have no answer in this museum to my question? You knew, Mr. Berenbaum, my question. How is it that I have no answer from the museum? And the man first said, "I don't see why I should answer your question. Who are you? You are nothing, or nearly nothing. Bradley Smith is nothing. Lindell is nothing. Why should I answer?" And I said, "Oh, sir, I think you have to answer my question. Because when you dare to say that the Germans had what you call gas chambers to kill people, this is an accusation. So if you have an accusation, you have to bring the proof of your accusation." And Berenbaum went mad. He said, "I don't see why I should answer." Finally, he got very irritated. And it was for him a real disaster because we had a conversation for perhaps half an hour. And at every point, he had to surrender. On, for example, about Prešak. So you see Prešak, but do you know that Prešak has totally changed his mind? He didn't know that, and so on. So it was something very interesting. Let me give you one specific point. In the museum, you had a, do you call that a mock-up?
Yes, probably a mock-up.
Yeah, a mock-up, yes. And people, simple visitors, would think that they have seen a gas chamber. It was a crematory, and the man who had done this mock-up said, "You see this place, it's a gas chamber," but without bringing any proof. Now, you must know something. Who is the man on earth who, for the first time, published the plans of the Auschwitz crematories? There were five of them. Who?
Mm-hmm. Who is the man who first published?
Yeah, myself. The answer is myself.
Mm-hmm.
On the 19th of March, 1976, in Auschwitz, I managed to find that since 1945, the archives in Auschwitz had those plans. They had never been shown.
Mm-hmm. So, and they have never been shown because they don't show what they are claiming to show.
Exactly. Exactly. Because once you have those plans, you can see that what those people who accuse Germany are saying is absolutely stupid. What they used to call gas chambers were what you call depository. I don't know if it's an English word, in fact. It's the place where you put the bodies mm-hmm. before the cremation.
Mm-hmm.
So when you see the place, when you see the poor dimensions of it, when you see that you had nothing specific for the ventilation and so on, you could immediately see that it is a silly story.
Yeah.
It's like someone showing, I don't know, any room in your own flat and saying, oh, this was a gas chamber, because we have witnesses who say that it was a gas chamber. You understand?
Yes, exactly. And that's it with not only the Holocaust legends, and I call it hoax, but so many other things, which are simply, as you say, silly, the perfect word, just silly, silly things. And that's why they get so upset.
And you see, sometimes, of course, I say that it is a lie. But most of the time, I don't say that it is a lie. I say that it is a historical lie. The difference is this one. Everybody understands what is a lie.
Mm-hmm.
It's the contrary of truth. Okay. But historical lie means that at the beginning, perhaps, most probably, you had people who lied. But afterwards, people repeated and repeated hearsay. So those people are of good faith. I call them believers. I don't call them liars. And we have plenty of believers like that.
What about the people who are telling falsehoods knowingly?
Of course.
There are a lot of them. I'm not talking about just the average person.
I don't know. I met so many of those real liars, of course. Mm-hmm. I read so many people like Elie Wiesel and so on. You could see that the man is lying.
Mm-hmm.
How do you say that in English? Through his teeth, no? Do you say
lying through his teeth, yes.
Yeah, you could see it, and you could prove it. You could prove it, because you can bring the proof of manipulations of the text and so on. But most of the people that I meet every day who believe in the genocide, who believe in the gas chambers, who believe in the 6 million... are simply people who believe. They believe something that is repeated morning after morning, day, night, and so on for years and years. So we have to excuse those people.
Oh, yes.
After all, myself, at the beginning, I believed also. I was a believer.
Mm-hmm.
But one day, I woke up and I thought, oh, now I don't want any more any blah blah. I want to go and see. And I want something that a policeman would ask. I acted like a professor, of course, but also like a policeman. And mm-hmm. I made an investigation. I asked so many questions to a place in Paris, which is what we call scientific police. I remember going to this place and asking question about what is Zyklon B, what is a gas, what is a gas chamber. I even, in the United States, I think it was in 1979, I went to visit a gas chamber in Baltimore. I wanted to see how a man could be executed with hydrocyanic acid, since Zyklon B was hydrocyanic acid. So I wanted to see how a man could be killed. And if you see an American gas chamber, it's finished. You cannot believe in the Nazi gas chambers. Because if you see an American gas chamber, for example, in Baltimore, you see that it's dreadful how it is complicated to gas someone without yourself being gassed. The real question, you see, is not to gas, to kill a man in a gas chamber. Very, very complicated, the gas chamber. The real question is, how are you going to get into the gas chamber and to handle the body? Because the body is poisonous. You are going to be killed by the poison which killed the man. Unless you have special fans and so on. It's extremely complicated.
Now, look at all of the time and effort you have put into this. And you're also a very highly academically trained person, very intelligent, and all of that, and you've put all of this effort into learning. But the average person won't even read a book. So, you know, here we're dealing with something that when we say, if you look into it, you will discover the truth, but most people refuse, are unwilling or too lazy or something to look into it. And how would you address this problem?
You are right. This is a real problem. Sometimes I feel desperate.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, the question is this one. If you take even, I don't know, a boy of 12 or someone who doesn't understand very much about anything, all the same, if you take the man, and if you say, come with me, we are going to visit Struthof, Maisweiler, or Majdanek, or Auschwitz, or Dachau, or whatsoever, any place. If you bring the man, if you say, see, look, but what you have there is, for instance, in Mauthausen, it's a shower room, and an ordinary one, absolutely ordinary. They have decided to call it a gas chamber. So you can ask the man, what do you think of that? You have a shower room. You have nothing else. And even if you go through the ages, I would say, you would see that at the beginning they would say that the gas was coming from the tapes. Then they said, oh no, it came from the right. And then they changed their mind. They said it came from the left and so on. So at that point you say, oh, I don't understand anymore. Could you show me a forensic examination? A real proof. For a criminologist, he would ask you proof. Show me. You have nothing. Exactly nothing.
Yes. Now, you're speaking really of a one-on-one experience. Now, if you can take somebody in hand and guide them along, yes, you can do it. But, of course, that would take a very, very long time since they're... But anyway, so let me ask you, what do you think of the value of videos in contrast to books that are really, you know, going into it deeply and very accurate. How do you see the value of videos in educating the public about?
Oh, of course, a video is better than books and so on, because you have to see. But it's even better to go and touch. I think it's important, but on one condition. You have to be as simple as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You mustn't try to show your science, to be like a professor, like a teacher. It's exasperating. You are making the things complicated when they are so simple. You have to go, for instance, you go in Auschwitz I, you go and visit this so-called gas chamber, and you see a little door with a glass, a window. And you say, now, there is something wrong. You have a window. I could break the window and the gas would gas everybody to write to the SS hospital was at 20 meters. You could see that this door opens inside. So if it opens inside, and if you had plenty of bodies, how could you open the door? Very simple things, you see.
Let me ask you, is the door at Auschwitz, and I was there, but they don't let you see much of anything anymore.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Is the door at the Auschwitz I supposed gas chamber, does that open to the inside?
Yes, from the inside.
Because I know the one at Majdanek does. Well, then, right there, why haven't they changed that door to make it open?
let me tell you, they have changed many, many things.
Mm-hmm.
And do you know that even in French historian, his name is Eric Conan, C-O-N-A-N. In January 1995, in a weekly very well known in France called L'Express, a Jewish one, Eric Conan, after reading my stuff, went to the place. And his conclusion on page 68 of this issue of the 19th of January 1945, now listen, I'm going to say it in French and then in English. Tout qui est faux, which means everything in it is false. Do you understand that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Everything. For instance, the holes on the roof, they have been made after the war by the communists.
Yes.
In order to make you believe that the nasty SS was pouring Zyklon B pellets by those holes. They never existed. And we know exactly, because I found the plans, we know exactly what it was in fact. It was two things. First, it was what I call a depository or mortuary. It was a mortuary, a very simple one,
mm-hmm.
with a dead end, you see, which is typical. And then, in 1944, it was changed into a air raid shelter with
yes.
the place for surgery, because it was quite close to the SS hospital. And in case of bombing, they needed a place for the surgeon, and they had three rooms, so it was changed. If you have good eyes, you could see today that there are traces of walls, because it was divided into three, four parts, you see. and so on.
Well, luckily people have taken very good photographs when they could still go in there and take those photographs and show what you're talking about. But, you know, today, they do not let anyone walk in there. It's roped off and you can only...
No, you are wrong. You are wrong. You can take photos. In this place, you can take photos.
But in the Auschwitz one?
People do not see what they have under their eyes. Mm-hmm. They see what they have in their brain, which is a mistake.
Very good. Yes. In your Victories of Revisionism, you make some points. You say that in 1968, the Jewish historian Olga Wormser-Migo said that Auschwitz I was categorized without any gas chamber.
Yes, that's right.
In 68, she said that, and now in all these years since, they still claim it. And she was a Jewish historian.
Yes, that's right. And I happened to visit her. I remember very well that I visited this Jewess, Olga Wormser-Migo, M-I-G-O-T.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember her reaction. Her reaction was, "Oh, Mr. Forisson, don't go into that. It's going to be terrible for you. It has been terrible for me." That's what she said. Now, wait a minute. When I decided to go into that, when I decided to publish some stuff about that, of course it was terrible for me. But do you know what she did? She wrote a little book in which she said that I was a liar.
Oh, no.
Yeah. She did
so,
it.
So she's in denial now about what she had said previously.
That's good.
I have to stop us now, Dr. Forisson. We have to take our break, and we will come right back with this in a few moments, ladies and gentlemen. Stick with us.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
The celebration was impromptu and palpable. A jubilation stretching from New York to the Naval Academy, heard inside sports arenas.
The crowd is chanting USA.
And exploding outside the White House.
It's wild out here. It's Mardi Gras. It's New Year's Eve.
It was neither. The wild crowd reflecting something of a World Cup victory was cheering on the assassination of public enemy number one, 9/11 mastermind Osama bin Laden. An American killing that inspired many mainstream media outlets to abandon objectivity and rejoice.
I had a sweet taste of revenge. I'm glad he's rotting in hell, which is exactly where I think he is this morning.
Evil suffers a mortal blow.
This is the greatest night of my career.
At some point, the unbridled euphoria over the death of a mass murderer garnered dance beats.
Osama was killed tonight, so everybody come and have a good time.
Yet for other Americans, this American way is nothing worth flaunting.
And it is this sort of bloodlust that we saw as people were chanting USA, USA, and celebrating bullets to the head of another human being.
The reported price of killing this human being has bled America's economy. According to the National Journal, the U.S. spent $3 trillion over 15 years to nab their man. In the interim, critics say the war on terror has cost the U.S. its reputation.
Let's remember that the people of Iraq had to endure an invasion of their country, killing hundreds of thousands of people that had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, a government that had nothing to do with Osama bin Laden. But at the end of the day, I mean, justice is in the eye of the beholder.
In this case, U.S. justice better reflecting an eye for an eye mentality.
This is bigger than the moon landing.
Ironically, America's galactic moon landing marked its 50th year anniversary May 5th, a moment largely overlooked during the Bin Laden frenzy. Alan Shepard's spaceflight promoted America the Great, America the Positive, America the Beacon. Today, a different side of America is on display.
We have over 6,000 U.S. service people who have been killed, tens of thousands injured. We have hundreds of thousands of civilians murdered around the world. Now, torture has become a part of U.S. foreign policy, and the idea of now celebrating because one man has been killed just doesn't seem rational or right to me.
While the touted face of terrorism has been eliminated, officials warn that terrorist threats to the U.S. have grown significantly worse over the decade. This as...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. My very special guest tonight is Dr. Robert Faurisson, the distinguished scholar and Holocaust revisionist who has done so much great work for the cause in all the past 40 or so years. And we were just talking about some Jewish historians who have said truthful things and then later denied that they said them or whatever else happened to them. Would you like to say anything more about that, Dr. Faurisson?
I think that we should spare a little bit of our time and go to something more important.
All right.
Yeah. I want to tell you this. The last scholar who tried to bring the proof that there were gas chambers was Jan van Pelt, P-E-L-T.
Mm-hmm.
He was the man who helped Deborah Lipstadt against David Irving. Okay. Mm-hmm. Something interesting happened on the 29th of December 2009. Suddenly, Van Pelt, who was desperately trying to find holes, openings in the roof of the ruins of the crematories in Birkenau, said this: everybody tries to find money for Auschwitz because the buildings are crumbling and so on. It's very expensive. My opinion is that we should drop all this, letting the thing drop, you see?
Yes.
To drop all this, to let it, no money, no more.
Mm-hmm.
And the man who was questioning Van Pelt said, yes, that with all those deniers, if you do that, you have no more proofs. And Van Pelt said, you must know that 99% of what we know, which means there were gas chambers, there was a genocide, does not find its proof in Auschwitz.
Mm.
Fantastic.
Yes.
I call him le dernier des Mohicans, the last of the Mohicans. He was the last to try to bring proofs.
Yes.
Van Pelt. And since that time, it's total silence. He said that, and it's the silence. And do you know that Jean-Claude Pressac, the French pharmacist, who worked for Klarsfeld, a very well-known Jew in France, Pressac, who had published a big, fat book in English in 1989, the Auschwitz gas chambers, technique and operation. This man, who was celebrated by the medias all over the world, and the medias were saying, Faurisson is finished. You see, Prayssac brought the proof. Now, listen. Prayssac himself, in 1995, he recanted. And he said, all this story is trash. It's good for the, how do you say that, the trash bins?
This yes, is trash bin.
Trash bin of his story.
Yes.
And do you know that for 5 years, we didn't know that Prayssac had written that. It was published only in 2000 by an historian on the side of the Jews named Valérie Igounet. She published that. Quite at the end of her book on denial in France.
Oh, and she was calling him a denier, or were they dealing with that? I mean, he wrote that, or he said it in 5 years before.
Wait a minute, Prayssac said the friend of Clausen published two books, and especially this big fat book in English, saying that the gas chambers had existed, and that he had the proof of that. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You understand that?
Yes.
Okay. But suddenly he changed his mind in 1995. If I had time enough, I could explain you why he changed his mind, but I have no time. The result is interesting. The result is that he wrote something, and the conclusion was, all this is lies, lies, lies. It's good for the trash bins of history. In 1995. But it was hidden from us. And he died in 2003. Okay. But we had this in 2000. For 5 years, it was kept secret.
Mm-hmm.
So it is interesting to see that people who are repeating, writing, saying everywhere there was a genocide, there were gas chambers and so on, it's interesting to see when those people are recanting. Raoul Hilberg is dead now, was the number one of those people. And you know what happened to Hilberg in 1985 in Toronto. It was a disaster for the man. When we told him, okay, there were two orders from Hitler to go and kill the Jews. Where are those orders?
Yes.
He had invented that. We said, okay, there was a plan to kill the Jews. Where is the plan?
Yes, you're talking about Hilberg.
Hilberg.
At the Zundel
trial. At the Zundel trial.
Mm-hmm.
It was something absolutely terrible for Zundel. And when in 1988, 3 years after, there was another trial, the prosecutor wrote to Hilberg to ask him to come back to testify. And you should see the letter of Hilberg. It meant, more or less, I'm afraid it's going to be too bad. It was so bad in 85, I don't want to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, okay, if there was a plan, where is it? You needed a budget for such a thing. Where is the budget? Where are the instructions? And so on. They have exactly nothing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why it was done in such a haphazard way, not costing much, because they didn't have a budget. You know, putting people into these cellars and saying that they were, you know, throwing gas in there.
So coming back to Prayssac, and to Van Pelt, I say, I think I can say, that the history of the gas chamber, the so-called gas chambers, the Jewish history of the gas chamber, died on the 29th of December 2009. Because on this very day, Van Pelt said, oh, you see, in Auschwitz, which is supposed to be the capital of the genocide, of course, has no proof.
Yes. Well, that brings us back to the really the biggest problem, which is access to the media. So you might say that this the Holocaust legend died, but the obituary never got to the people. So they don't know that, and they don't know any of these facts.
You are quite right. That's the real problem. We are lucky enough with Internet. Mm-hmm. I remember that in 1995, when I went once more to United States, two gentlemen who were revisionists said, oh, now we have the solution. It's Internet. At that time, I didn't believe too much. I must say that all the same, now we are making progress.
Okay,
don't think that I believe in the revisionist Santa Claus. No, it will not come like that. Because it has become a religion. You understand that?
Yes,
it's a religion.
That.
And yes. It's very difficult. You cannot fight a religion by reason. No. If a religion dies, it's because another religion is coming.
Yes.
That's why sometimes I am rather pessimistic.
How do you think that a new religion about this can replace, or what would replace, this religion of the Holocaust?
I don't know. I don't see. I don't like to talk about the future, you see.
Mm-hmm.
I can't talk about the past, about the present. About the future, I cannot tell you anything. Now, let me give you a piece of news. At the end of this year, 2011, a French historian is in his 40s. It's going to publish a book, and I'm going to give you the title of it.
Oh.
The title is The Black Box of the Holocaust.
Hmm.
Do you know who had the idea of the Black Box of the Holocaust? It's President Ahmadinejad.
Oh.
He one day he said this. I find that very clever. He said, do you know that in the Western countries, theaters, historians, people are forbidden to go and approach the black box of the Holocaust to see what is inside?
Yes, I have heard that, yes.
That, I think it's a good idea.
Yes, well, who's publishing this, or who wrote this book?
No, it's not written yet. It's going to be published at the end of this year, and I don't have the right to give you the name of this historian.
All right. Well, that's exciting.
Yeah, that's exciting, as you say.
Well, there are a lot of people working all the time, working on things, and so we don't always know what's going on.
And something else, we have a young teacher. His name is Vincent Renoir.
Yes. I've been in contact with him.
Okay. He's a very clever man, and you know that he has been in prison.
Yes, and let me say his name in the English, in the Americanized version, so people know who you're talking about. It's what we would kind of say Vincent Renoir, or Renard. Yes,
yeah.
And people are familiar with that. Okay.
R-E-Y-N-O-U-A-R-D.
Yes.
He is the father of 8 children.
Mm-hmm.
And he was put in prison because he had published a paper, 16, only 16 pages with photos.
Yes, and that has now been released in English on the internet just the other day.
Yes, I'm afraid with some mistakes, but it's going to be corrected.
Oh, good.
Okay, but you see, so those people are obliged now to put a father of 8 children in prison for 16 pages. Is it not interesting?
Well, if we went through the whole list of all the horrible, unbelievable,
horrible,
and unfeeling things they have done, and that should be done. How about a book like that, all of that documented?
Yes, but one day I suppose that someone will do it. Myself, I have no time to do it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting you should do it, but...
Yeah, no, and you know, this kind of book might be... not a very good idea, because if people see what we have suffered, they are already so shy, they are going to be even more shy.
Well, at some point people get outraged, I think.
Yes.
I'm not sure,
Some.
Mm. Well, you made a suggestion in one of the things you've written, and that was about the future. And I think it could be a good project. Would you still support this, that you said UNESCO, in 1979, at the request of the Polish government, put the Auschwitz camp or Auschwitz memorial on its list of World Heritage and Cultural Property Sites, which thus constituted that it had to be supported financially by everyone. And
mm-hmm.
But you call it an offense against education, science, and culture.
Yeah.
And could you explain that a little bit more?
I think that to bring young boys and girls to this place and to tell all those silly stories, all those lies, it's a kind of, it is disgusting. You have no right to exploit like that those children or those young people.
Do you think it would be a good idea to as a serious project that we really would expect to complete successfully, to approach UNESCO on these grounds, or do you think
I did it because I knew what that the UNESCO had some responsibility in all this, but you see, it's political, and you are not going to to change the mind of those political people if they think that they have any interest in lying. They are going to keep on lying. They are not going to change. It would be an extraordinary scandal if one day in the UNESCO would decide that Auschwitz was an ordinary concentration camp and nothing else.
Yes, of course they would never do that. It's impossible. Well, then in the last 5 minutes that we have, or 4 minutes, let me ask you about your days during the World War II when you were living in Marseille and in Paris. You said you were, in those 5 years, 40 to 45, you were between 10 and 15 years old. And you give some examples in one of your interviews about how you experienced that. You say that the Jews were quite free to move about, and yet at one point, this was, you know, the Germans were occupying the country, and they said a French policeman would never dare to lay a hand on a Jew during that time, even though the Germans were occupying the country, and that at one point, some youths who were pro-collaboration set off a little bomb in front of a synagogue, which didn't hurt anyone, and they were arrested and held in jail, and one of them was beaten so badly while he was in jail that he died from the beating. And was he being beaten by French police, or were Jews involved in that, or what?
I'm going to answer, but first, please, I have to correct you on one point.
Okay.
I never said that during the war, the Jews could be free going this way or that way. No, never, never I said that. What I said is that we have many proofs that the Jews during the war, you had absolutely no right to kill a Jew or even to beat a Jew.
That's right.
You told about the synagogue was in Vichy on the 17th of August 1941. And this is so well hidden that myself, living in Vichy, I didn't know the story. I learned it in New York when I went in 79 and I looked for the New York Times during the war. Suddenly, I stumbled on this, the story of some young French who had wanted to explode a little bomb in front of the synagogue. And there were no damages, really. They were immediately arrested, and one of those young people was beaten so severely at the police station in Vichy that he died. And I found the judgment of the explosion, eh? Mm-hmm. And all of them were sentenced to, I don't remember what, but they were sentenced anyway. And you had an old man in Vichy, very well known, he was a pharmacist, and one day an American came and asked him, oh, it might have been terrible for you in Vichy during the war. And this man, his name was Benamou said, no, of course there were restrictions and so on, but, and the American said, yes, but certainly some people did insult you. And the man answered, no question. If he had insulted me, he would have been in trouble. And this has been printed in a little book written, published by an American, a Jew.
All right.
Many exaggerations. Don't think that I am without any pity for the Jews during the war. Of course, the war is terrible, terrible for anyone. But, you see, only Jews are supposed to have suffered.
Well, who would have beaten that French boy who was a Nazi sympathizer? Who would have beaten him so badly? It certainly wouldn't have been the Nazis who did that.
No. They were. No. You must understand that in Vichy, 1941, mm-hmm. the people, Marshal Pétain and so on, they didn't want things like that, to put a bomb in front of a synagogue. They said that it was scandalous. They said
all
it.
Right.
And the police, the people of the police, thought that they were thugs and nothing else. And that's it. And you had, in the police, you had many people on the side of the resistance.
Mm-hmm.
Of course.
Yes. Well, we have, we have run out of time, Dr.
Yeah.
Farsan. And
okay.
I thank you so much for informing us about all of these things. And I would really love to have you back on so that you can tell us some more. You are a fount of information. And I want to thank you for coming on this program.
Thank you, Caroline.
All right.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Ladies and gentlemen, come back next week. Thank you very much. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.